Welcome to this special series of Moneyball Medicine focused on AI, machine learning, and analytics applied to drug discovery and development. This special series was recorded as part of the AI Application Summit produced by Corey Lane Partners this October in Boston, Massachusetts. I'm your host, Harry Glorikian. In this series, I will interview different speakers from the event and we will hear their experiences. We will dive into the challenges and opportunities they're facing and their predictions for years to come. Welcome to Moneyball Medicine. The cost to develop and gain FDA approval for a new drug today is more than $2.5 billion, according to the Tufts Center for the Study of Drug Development. Driving much of that cost are human clinical trials. A core function of a successful clinical trial is finding patients who fit the predetermined eligibility criteria and getting them to participate. Harris Interactive did a study of 6,000 cancer patients back in October of 2000 that found that 85% were unaware that participation in clinical trials was even an option. Of the patients surveyed, 75% said that if participation in a clinical trial had been offered, they would have been receptive to the idea. When patient recruitment is impeded, trials are delayed, sometimes by years, until the numbers of patients required by the study protocol can be enrolled. What if we can find those patients in minutes rather than months? What if I can get my drug trial started faster than my competitor? What if my hospital can participate in more clinical trials than it does today? My next guest and his company are working on a focus to tackle exactly those issues. So Woot Bresselers is the CEO and founder of DeepSix AI, which uses natural language processing and artificial intelligence on clinical data to accelerate clinical trial recruitment and analysis. DeepSix originated in one of the world's most competitive data environments, the U.S. intelligence space. Woot started his career as a diplomat in the Middle East before joining McKinsey & Company, serving blue chip and startup clients across Asia and the rest of the world. Next, Woot founded an extreme sports adventure company in Singapore, then spent 5 years in the high-stakes world of international security, growing and leading a 22,000 headcount organization across four continents into a $500 million global player. Woot, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Harry. Pleasure to be here.
Woot, tell us a little bit about DeepSix.
Sure. So DeepSix, as you mentioned, right, started in the US intelligence community. We started by beating up some of the big boys in analytics and machine learning at the time, including IBM Watson, HP Autonomy, etc. We built one of the first data science ML platforms for one of the big agencies, and then decided to atone for our sins and do something useful with our time, with our talents, and we moved into healthcare. Our initial foray into healthcare was actually via the Techstars Healthcare Accelerator. And one of the things that we saw, or that we actually did, is we interviewed more than 500 luminaries of healthcare, right? From physicians to nurses, researchers, hospital executives, payers, basically everybody in the ecosystem. Because at that time, we were really a solution looking for the right problem to solve. Now, one thing that we learned early on is that almost everybody in healthcare has opinions and has potential solutions for the many problems or the many inefficiencies in the system there, right? But one thing that almost everybody had in common is they said that for every new solution, for every new medical device, drug, procedure, right, anything new that touches a patient has to go to clinical trials to show that it's safe and to show that it works. And that gatekeeping function of clinical trial actually has become a bit of a bottleneck. In recent years, in the US alone, we've been trying to recruit up to 7 million patients a year for clinical trials, and we barely ever managed to recruit more than 2.2 million. So you see the gap is enormous. And as a result, like you mentioned, 90% of clinical trials are going over time and over budget. So we decided if we really want to make a ding into the many problems that plague healthcare, clinical trials might be the way to go. Because if we're successful in indeed finding patients for trials in minutes instead of months, we can actually accelerate innovation in healthcare as a whole.
So you used a lot of different language, machine learning, NLP. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing, how you're doing it, not necessarily the secret sauce, but sort of, you know, what makes you guys able to accomplish what you're doing? And then what are the ultimate goals of the company in the process that you're taking?
Sure. No, I'd love to do that, actually. And you start with a good point, right? I mean, there's a lot of hype about AI in healthcare in general. Some companies have hyped a little bit too much and actually are paying a price for it. Our general philosophy is that AI is not going to be a differentiator in the medium to long run. And it's even in the short to medium run, right? Everybody's embracing AI. AI is going to become as ubiquitous as an Excel spreadsheet. So it's not just about the AI and the techniques, but it's how you actually build a product around AI and how you solve a problem where AI is part of it. Apart from AI, obviously, there is a UI as well. There's a user interface, and it's making sure that you offer a user the most straightforward and most intuitive way to solve a problem that they care about. We always say that AI plus UI equals ROI, right? Return on investment for the user. So what we really started from was the idea that there is a lot of clinical data, right, that exists in healthcare that is fragmented and that is disparate and basically exists in many different databases. You have the EMR data, you have the pathology reports, you have genomic data, you have social worker notes, you have PACS, LIS, all of those different things, you have claims data. We kind of started from how can we unify all those different data types and make sure that we build what we call a 360-degree view of a patient that has all of the relevant clinical data sources to allow to select patients for clinical trials or other type of cohorts. Now, the key thing, as you know, with medical records and with healthcare is that up to about 85 to 90%, depending on the source, of all that clinical data is in unstructured format. So they're basically images or notes, right, that do not really have a label. It's long text where a physician sits down with a patient and starts saying, well, my patient, John Smith, suffers from this. These are the symptoms. PSA values have actually gone up over time. ECOG score is this, etc. This can be a long blob of text. Now, traditional software can manage text and can actually find and retrieve and recognize data by labeling the data, by saying this is a symptom, this is a disease, this is a lab value, etc. As a physician sits down and writes all of that just in the notes, there is no labeling that happens. EMRs do have a lot of labels in the discrete fields, but it's really cumbersome for a physician's workflow to have to obey that and stop instead of talking to a patient and just jotting things down, to stop and chase down a drop-down box and say, well, this is the symptom, I'm going to enter the symptoms here, and this is where I'm going to put my medication. It really is disruptive to the patient-physician relationship.
Not to knock the EMRs, but isn't that what the EMRs were supposed to be doing?
Well, one of the better quotes that I've heard about EMRs, right, is that they make hospitals more profitable but less productive. So they capture a lot of data, but their ultimate goal still is to capture that data to facilitate billing and make sure that nothing goes unbilled. Everything you say or do in hospital can and will be used for billing, not necessarily to provide better clinical care.
Right. I like to say that it's, you know, they were originally designed for that because value-based outcomes and managing patients wasn't the goal when the software first got written.
And many of them are really built on legacy systems, right? I could foresee that an EMR of the future would be much more voice-driven, right? It's speech-to-text, and you can just interface with it, and it will automatically structure your data, not as cumbersome as it is today. I mean, you can use so many more modern techniques today and completely redesign the EMR. And trust me, when we were talking to physicians and nurses and everybody during our accelerator phase, everybody asked us that. You know what? AI is all great, but can you build me a better EMR?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, doesn't everybody wish? Unfortunately, I'm not sure that that's going to happen anytime soon. But it sounds like you're using the EMR as almost a data lake, a repository, and you're reaching in to pull out what you need.
Yep, absolutely. And actually, we go beyond the EMR, right? Most health systems today already have some kind of a data lake or an electronic data warehouse where they already combine multiple databases and systems, right? The EMR takes up a lot of that because EMRs are kind of consolidating a lot of data already, but they don't have everything. So we also take like bioregistry information, there can be sensor data, there can be any type of clinical data that is relevant, is typically unified somewhere in one or more data lakes. What we do is we take all of that data And then instead of representing it as a combination of different relational databases, we unified into one single graph database. And I think if there's one thing that really sets us apart from, at least a while ago, almost every other healthcare company, and today I think still more than 99%, it's really our use of graph databases to representations. So in our architecture, a patient becomes a multidimensional vector that contains tens or hundreds of thousands of nodes and edges, basically clinical concept like this is a symptom, this is a disease progression, this was a diagnosis, this was a medication order, this is a lifestyle choice, etc. This is a genomic or a biomic observation. All of those things live in a graph, and we try to also map all the relationships between those different concepts, not just for one single patient, but across the patient database as well. And of course, that's a tall order. Right now, we take most of the edges as they come from the data, but as we get more and more patients' records in and create more and more of those patients' vectors, right, we hope to see a lot more and learn a lot more about this patient, a lot more than that patient. And typical patients who have concepts or symptoms A, B, and C also have diagnosis D, right? That's really an application of a lot of the link analysis and stuff, hidden player detection that we did for the intelligence community.
So this is eventually going to be a lot more than just a clinical trial matching platform.
Eventually, yes. As newcomers to the healthcare space, we have to admit that we had some degree of hubris when we started. We were thinking we're going to build a collective medical intelligence based on this data model, but we were kind of overlooking the need for immediate economics, right? And the needed ROI for our clients. So we kind of scaled back our initial ambitions and said, if we start with clinical trials, it's a very direct and vertical problem that has incredible downstream effects across the whole health system, for health systems, for patients, for sponsors, pharma companies, device companies, and also for payers. So if we can somehow tackle this and show a very strong ROI, a very big impact on this, we at the same time are solving one of the biggest problems in healthcare, and we're collecting all of this data that will allow us to actually then do more and build towards that goal of having a collective medical intelligence that is not just descriptive, but can also be predictive.
So can you give me, or the, you know, all of us listening, some real examples of where the technology has been implemented and, you know, examples where it's made a difference? And, you know, you don't have to tell me anything confidential, but just something that people can sort of wrap their mind around in a real world example.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I said before, right, AI is all great, but you have to deliver results. We are using less and less the word artificial intelligence, and we're more and more just focusing on product. And as we grow, the UI, the workflow, and everything else becomes just as important. And metrics that we get from that, that's what we really live by. So the thing that we really try to accomplish for health systems and for trial sponsors are getting patients in minutes instead of months. And that solves a couple of things, right? Today, as you know, many trials get started, but they never succeed in finding the patients that they're supposed to accrue, right? And then they stop and they fail and the whole trial falters, right? And that affects the patients who've been donating their time and their energy for nothing. It affects the sites that then actually they could have used their resources somewhere else. And the same thing for pharma companies. So one of the key things that we do by having all of that data of patients and being able to match them with clinical trial criteria, we can tell you whether a trial is even feasible, right? So we can say, like, if you're looking for patients with, say, prostate cancer, and they must have radical prostatectomy, they must have these PSA values, this and this and this, we can tell you, yes, across this network of sites where we're set up, there are 15,000 patients. And if you then filter that down by additional criteria, it brings it down to, say, 500 patients across the network. That is sufficient to do a study if you're trying to, say, recruit 50 patients, right? Then statistics come into play. The next thing is then also tell them, where are the sites that have these patients? As you know, today, 50% of all the sites that are being selected for a trial will fail to recruit more than 0 or 1 patients. So that's an enormous waste of resources. So we can help with that as well. And then the final thing is actually really reducing the time it takes to actually recruit and onboard those patients. And we are now still focusing on identifying them and sending messages to the treating physicians to help with the actual recruitment. But we want to go a lot further. Eventually, we want to go to a place where we actually call pop-up trials. Like you have a pop-up restaurant that actually sets up where you have a hopping happening area where patients will walk by and you have a good chef and you make it happen. We're going to do the same thing with clinical trials where we say, we have patients here for these kind of diseases. Let's reach out to the sponsors and make sure that, and to the sites, we have a cluster here of patients and a cohort that could be very beneficial for these type of trials. Let's condense everything that it takes to normally set up a trial at a site, which can take up to a year and a half, try to bring it down to 30 days and make it happen immediately. So that's the whole pop-up thing. So where we are today to make all of that happen is really focusing on that immediate identification. And some of the success stories that we've had early were, for instance, we had a principal investigator doing a non-small cell lung cancer study at Cedars-Sinai. And she had been able to find 23 patients in the previous 12 months on her study, find and recruit. So it's not too bad, but she needed to get to 50 patients. When we started out, and this is now almost 2 years ago, we had just ingested only 10,000 oncology patients from the Cedars-Sinai database. And we had built a very early alpha version of the tool. And we sat down with that PI and we actually gave her a free rein. So, here, copy and paste in your eligibility criteria and let's see if you can use this to find your patients. Actually, literally 8 minutes later, she had found, identified, and validated 58 matching patients for her study, which was a big success, actually better than we'd expected. And one of the things that helped us in retrospect, which we didn't know beforehand, is that if you're looking for non-small cell lung cancer patients, again, that's where the structured data falls down. You will only have, say, ICD-9 or ICD-10 codes or fields or problem lists where they talk about lung cancer of the left lung cancer of the right lung cancer, etc. They will not specify that it's lung cancer with the specifics of non-small cell or large cell, right? So what she had to do previous to us is ask her IT team to find all the patients with lung cancer and then manually go through all of those records, right, in the EMR or in the pathology reports to see which of those over 800 patients actually had lung cancer of the non-small cell. With our tool, she could see that immediately. So we brought down the number of patients she had to review to probably 80 or 90 or something, and then she could go through them, validate, look for all the other stuff, see if they were a match for the criteria, and then again, within 8 minutes, have 58 selected. So that was one of the early successes. A little bit later, we are a self-service product, right? So we're not a service. We really are a software product that our users use. Now we're being used at, we're deploying to between 12 and 15 different health systems, mostly in the US, but now also two in Australia. So we have over, I think, 250 users right now across those centers, and they're using it on trials every day, I would say. One big success we had also at Cedars-Sinai, where we actually helped out, was when we were working with a big pharma company trying to find patients for a cardio study. And what we did there is we actually helped the PI on that study. It was called the FUEL study. She had been able to recruit two patients over 6 months. So you can question whether what was happening there, whatever. The criteria were kind of hard. But she had two walk-in patients that she signed up. When we actually trained her on our product, she identified 19 patients, then went through the validation. And 33 minutes later, she had 16 of those fully validated, and she reached out to them. 3 weeks later, 8 of those patients had been recruited on the study. So from 2 patients in 6 months to 8 patients on the study in 3 weeks, that was a big success. So our goal is really in not talking too much about AI or anything else, but really focusing on the metrics, finding more patients,
so give me
better matching faster.
Yeah, give me an example of, like, if you had to quantify that for either the hospital that's utilizing it or maybe the pharmaceutical company that's, partnered with this, because it takes two, right, to sort of tango on this to a certain degree. What's the overall time savings that you might be able to estimate and the cost savings that you would see from this?
Sure. And in full disclosure, right, every day we're finding out new ways where we can help with efficiencies or new revenue gains. So the data that we have, where I feel like we have something that's more than anecdotal and that's kind of scalable, is data that has been provided by our users. We actually had an oncologist from Cedars-Sinai who presented about us at HIMSS earlier in 2018. And the talk of her, or the title of her talk, was the ROI of AI. And she basically used DeepSix as her one use case. And what they did is they looked at 79 retrospective clinical trials where they compared the use of our tool versus previous IT-enabled searches or actually asking physicians for quotes, etc., the way they had done it in the past. Across those 79 studies, and they kind of ran the gamut of phase one, phase two, some phase three, etc. So they all have their own characteristics, right? She found that they saved on average about 210 hours per study, only in labor savings, right? They also found that there were 14 studies that failed. And for five of those 14, they actually found studies in retrospect with our tool that they did not find before. So five of them we actually could have found. The other nine, we indicated that there were no patients in the system. So they could have avoided spending money and time and resources on those nine studies from the start. So there's that, and that wasn't really quantified in her study. She just said that nine studies we wouldn't have wasted time and effort on. Five studies we could have found patients for. So the metrics that she did find was on average 210 hours per study saved, and we used a very simple $50 per hour for that. So that came to about, I think, in total, $16,000 per study, and about $820,000 for those 79 studies, right? But that's only one mechanism. The other metric that she found was on average they found 121% increase in the number of patients that they found across all the studies. So more than double the patients that they found before. So that was good as well. If you then multiply that with the milestone fees and the treatment fees, that is a whole other revenue gain for the system. But she didn't really qualify or quantify that as much. She only had the number of patients on average, not the additional revenues from that, because she wasn't really as exposed to that.
I've been in this a little longer than you've been in this, but right now it's a room full of people typically, or people combing through this, you know, one by one by one by one. Where do you see this going as a business and industry? Because I think rooms full of people now become not as important as they once were because of the enablement of the technology.
I completely agree, right? I mean, technology allows for many more network effects and for, I'd say, extramural searches for patients. You could basically create a global platform, or at least a US platform, where different institutions, sites, and sponsors could tie together to share some de-identified patient data and do feasibility counts and even help each other finishing studies, right? You could basically have decentralized studies where you start a study at one site. If you don't have the patients, you can enroll somebody at another site to help you out or whatever, or even refer patients, etc. The big question there is more, are sites ready to do that? Are sites open to share data and become more collaborative in these efforts than they are today? And maybe that's where sponsors can help provide incentives to make that happen. We believe that many things are going to happen because we have data now that are going to basically erase some of the boundaries between traditional methods of care and clinical trials. You'll have basically trials as treatments as trials, etc. You can have more N-of-1 studies. I think having all of that data and looking beyond the walls of your own institution and saying, if there are a limited number of patients with this condition, right? But if I can at least look at my entire, say, US population or even global population to come up with a statistically significant cohort or sample, right? I can start doing N-of-1 samples within my sites, but then pull them together and compare them with some of the other patients. So there's so much that can happen if organizations go away from that super proprietary model of owning their data and keeping it completely locked off to other collaborators.
You know, it's always interesting when someone from outside the industry comes in and the first question they think is like, well, why can't we do stuff like this? So it's always a breath of fresh air to have people coming in that aren't steeped in, well, we only do it this way. Let me jump to a different topic here. So, you know, for all intensive purposes, you're a young startup. What are some of the challenges you've faced, you know, trying to get this company moving forward?
How much time do we have?
How about just the highlights?
Yeah, the typical highlight is something you alluded to before, right? Is healthcare systems are not fast moving. We often make a joke like, yeah, we left the government space to go to a fast moving industry where everything happens like in real time, and that's healthcare. And people who know healthcare start laughing because they know no, that is absolutely not healthcare, right? We really think we have a transformative product, right? I would say it's more than just technology, it's a product, and we can offer a lot of value. It is being a small startup with something new and not being an industry insider, and then convincing everybody else of what we think we can do, right? That takes time. Typically, decision-making in health systems is very consultative. We always say, like, you have to convince 35 people to say yes to get a deal done with a hospital, but if any single person says no, you're dead. Whereas in other industries, you can get decisions done, you can actually sign a contract sometimes in 1, 2, or 3 months. In healthcare, the average is probably 12 months. We've bucked the trend in a couple of cases, and we were able to close a couple of contracts in 4 months or 6 months, which you think is great, but those are the early adopters. So a big challenge for us is to be able to ride out that wave and condense these sales cycles and actually get into those systems faster. And I think that's true for many startups in our situation.
You're in a field that is moving, and I don't mean the healthcare field, but the technologies that you're implementing seem to be moving at an exponential rate, whether it's hardware technology and chipsets or software that goes along with that, and then the all the skills to actually like implement that. How are you guys keeping up with the hardware software aspect of this?
It's another great question, Harry, because there is a risk that you become too dependent on your own legacy technology and that you fail to innovate. We're very aware of that, right? I believe that any current technology that companies have today will probably only be what is called a defensive mode for 12 to 18 months at best, right? So we have to be ruthless ourselves in cannibalizing our own technology. We have replatformed. I mean, we wrote the first line of code for our products a little over 2 years ago, July 2016. I mean, the new version of a product, right? We have replatformed 3 times since then, and we've radically altered our data model twice on those systems, and we kind of have to, because we're always trying to think about what could we do that's completely new, that's out of the box, that would make this 10 times better. And sometimes that's a pain, because sometimes we just build something, we think it's great, and we started training users on it, and then we think of something that could make it even better, that's something new. I mean, we've partnered with a couple of open source projects, we've partnered with a couple of companies. At some point, we're talking to Cray Computers, a supercomputer, a company that was building a new, very fast language, Chapel. So we're looking at all of those new things, we're reading all the white papers, we're trying stuff. And sometimes it's painful because we have a team that actually has worked day and night on something new. And after 3 months, we're ready to basically push it. And then we say, you know what? We found something we can do again. So it's back to the galleys. Let's try to see what else we can do. Now, we can still do that today. I'm not sure for how long we will be able to do that, because at some point when you're deployed at thousands of customers and you have to do all of these new deployments and updates, etc., and you have to train your users, it can become a little bit hard. We were doing a pilot with a very large and very renowned system, and over the 3 months of the pilot, we basically pushed out updates every 2 weeks, and they at some point asked us to stop. So guys, we cannot handle this. I mean, can you just take a step back and take a little bit slower so we can get used to what you're doing? And they were absolutely right. That was a good lesson for us. Like, we cannot only focus on innovation doing that. We also have to think about stability and allow users to get used to stuff. So,
but you have to keep up with it. That's the part that I've learned through, reading and talking and looking at these different systems and playing around. And it's some of these chip updates are a 10x improvement. I'm sorry, a 1000x improvement in, capability. So if you don't keep up with it, the next guy, might blow past you, depending on where you are in the dynamic. So where are you? I mean, you're in Pasadena. I've never thought about Pasadena as the hub of software development. I mean, I could be wrong. How are you hiring and keeping these people that are doing all this work?
Well, the good thing about Pasadena, I mean, it's 5 minutes away from Los Angeles, right? But you have one of the premier universities in the U.S. Caltech is literally 2 blocks away from us. We have JPL, right, where they built the Mars rover. A little bit further, we have Parsons. We have Idea Labs, Bill Gross's accelerator, right? So there's OpenText. There's quite a good enterprise software ecosystem and kind of science ecosystem in Pasadena, surprisingly. So we're lucky to be able to tap into that. Is that enough as we grow? Maybe not. The good thing is that LA is building kind of a a nascent healthcare system as well, and in no small part thanks to that healthcare accelerator that is there. It's attracting more startups and more talent, and it's kind of putting it on the map. Having said that, getting talent and attracting talent is always a struggle. At this point, it's a seller's market, right? And you have to make sure that you keep on reaching out, you keep on growing. I tell all of our executives and everybody, whenever you see somebody who you think is great, make sure you invite them for a coffee. Even if we don't have room for them right now, we should keep the conversation open, because sometimes you just have to strike when the iron is hot, right? When you see somebody. Talent is one of the new big commodities that you have to fight for.
Yeah, talent like you said, I don't think it's the software. I do believe this whole concept of these words, AI and machine learning, are going to be passé. It's the tool that's being used. I actually think it's the data and how it's being implemented that's the secret sauce, which I think many companies are going to have difficulty with that transition, because you do need two pieces of the puzzle to make these things successful.
You're absolutely right. And at some point, right, you cannot keep thinking about the technology. The technology is only there to serve the product, and the product is there to solve a problem for your users. So you really have to always listen to your users and think, how can I do better? I think one of the strengths that we have, and I think it's a really big strength, but it has the potential to be a weakness, is we are very, very passionate product people. All of our people that we have on the engineering team, the product team, actually the UI, UX, we really care about our product, and I spend a lot of time on it, and I have to be careful not to become a bottleneck, because I'm so multitasked and I'm traveling a lot, etc. But I do care a lot about our product, what it looks like, what it feels like, its metrics. I want to test everything that we do. And again, you can hear the inherent bottleneck in there, right? So there definitely is a risk, but I also think it's good. We are a product company. We started as an AI company, but today we're a product company, and the AI is there to serve the product. And if at some point the AI no longer is doing that, we'll look at the next thing. How can we always make this product better and better? What is the next new thing that will keep pushing the boundaries of that?
Well, Wood, I don't want to take up any more of your time. I want to thank you so much for joining us on the show. I hope everybody enjoyed the discussion. And I look forward to continuing our conversation offline.
Thanks, Harry. This has been great.
And that's it for this special series of AI, machine learning, and analytics. If you enjoyed Moneyball Medicine, please head over to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. It is greatly appreciated. Hope you join us next time. Until then, farewell.